This Dharma talk was given to the Clearway Zen Sangha by Lotus Vu. This talk is made available free of charge. More information about Clearway Zen can be found at www.clearwayzen.ca.
So today is the start of our reconvene of the in-person sitting in Regina. I always found it interesting to be sitting in the room in the presence of other people. It's always a little bit different than sitting by yourself at home. You can feel your body, your mind settles a little bit faster with the collective energy of the Sangha in your presence. I have a friend of the family who I knew as a kid, and he doesn't understand Buddhism, even though he goes to temple. He doesn't practice meditation at all. So he used to say, "I really don't understand why people would want to get together and sit together and not say anything to each other." So you're not really communicating anyway. It's like, yeah, come together and sit with each other to be alone with each other. But sitting together, coming together as a Sangha to practice together, it's very significant to the Buddha. You can go solitary into the woods and practice alone, but he designates the Sangha as one of the three gems, one of the three precious things, pillars of Buddhism. And the practice together is one of the pillars of the Buddhist practice. Why? Because when we sit together as a group, our collective energy is kind of connected with each other. And although we have this appearance that we're separate individual, but if you ask a quantum physicist, they would tell you no. Your skin appears to be a barrier, but it's very porous. Everything is sort of communicating, sort of always free flowing. All these energies in the room are collective energy. And so when we come together to practice, what are we practicing? We are practicing mindfulness. I don't like that word very much because the word, well, it starts with the word mind, and then you have the word full. Means your mind's full of stuff, but it's actually the opposite. When we meditate, when we sit, when we practice Zen, we're doing something called shikantaza, which is just sitting. We're clearing our mind, and it becomes no mind, or an empty mind. Is the ultimate experience of Zen, where there are no thoughts, no feelings. And at some point in the Zen practice, yeah, there's an absence of sensation as well. Why would you want to go there? Just look at your mind as you're sitting in the last half an hour. How full is it? So many things are going on in there. It's almost like a tidal wave of stuff, one going after another. In psychology, they call it a stream of consciousness. It's like it's flowing like a river and nonstop with all kinds of things you cannot control. It goes into the past, it goes into the future, it goes into God knows what. And if you look closely, if you observe closely, the stream of consciousness that's always flowing in your mind, it's full of thoughts that not very useful. I call it garbage thoughts. Things you don't need right now. You know? It's like your mind would go, I do that tomorrow. Oh, that's yesterday. You know, oh, that was so nice. Oh, that person was so horrible. What is that? It's just chatters. Right? So that is an indication of awareness, our attention, being on in thinking process and trapped in there. So in the foundations of mindfulness, or you know, the foundations of observations that the Buddha taught, the first thing we do is bring our attention to the body and observe the body. What does that do? Take a moment and bring your attention to your body. Observe from the top of your head, do a quick scan down your back of your neck, shoulders, chest, stomach, your butt right on the ground, your knee, your feet touching the ground. Now, what do you notice? In that little scan, you're not thinking. Right? While you're observing the body, you're scanning it. What happened to your thoughts then? It's silent. What essentially you just did was shifted your attention away from the mental processes and brought it and placed it on the body. This is the first foundation of mindfulness that the Buddha taught, is to shift our attention away from our mental processes and place it on the body. Becoming in touch with our body awareness. And so if there's tension in the body, we know there's tension, we relax it. If there's our body's complaining anywhere, there's pain or discomfort, we check in. Usually that's an indication of something that we need to take care of. And the next part of the observation that the Buddha taught is to observe how our senses, when making contact with its, you know, the objects that correspond to the sense, how it reacts. So take a moment and use your sense of smell. Smell what's in the room. You notice any smell? Is there something noticeable? Start to notice subtle things that wasn't there before. As you focus on the sense of smell, if you notice any smell or fragrance in the room, as it makes contact, your senses of smell, your smell consciousness, your awareness of the smell, of the ability to smell, touches the corresponding things that it can detect. Notice how your awareness is looking for, what is this? Let's label this. What is it? What is this smell, right? And then the next thing that happens is, I like this. I don't like this. So there's a preference right away. I like this, I don't like this, or there's neutral. So that act happens almost instantaneously. So the recognition, slapping a label on, and then developing that preference. I like it, I don't like it, I'm neutral. Right? So this is the second foundation of the Buddha's teaching on observing. I don't like the word mindfulness. I like to use the word observing. That's what you're doing. You're observing, right? Observing without any judgments, without any preconceptions of what you're observing. So I want you to pay attention to your body sensation as you're sitting here. Notice any tension, any discomfort anywhere. Notice your mind as it starts labeling. As you notice any tension or discomfort in your feet or your leg or your shoulder, it starts labeling. It says, well, what's this? I could have been slapping on my neck last morning, this morning. Need to change the pillow. So right away it starts interpreting, yeah? Whatever is detected. It starts preference. Oh, this feels really uncomfortable. Let me move. Right? So right away it starts manipulating what it sees, yeah? Without actually truly investigating what's going on. So this impulse to label things, to develop almost an instantaneous preference, and then react towards that preference of moving towards it, or grasping it, or pushing it away as an aversion, or I call it resistance. This preference causes this movement, this sort of subtle movements in the perceptions of reality. It causes a slight anxiety. Because what happens when you don't like something and you try to push it away? You feel this is energy of irritation. This energy of irritation. Ugh, I don't like it. Get away from me. And if this thing that you dislike doesn't want to get it, you can't push it away, you can't escape from it, you know? Then internally, we're trying to distance from it by, kind of putting some sort of mental barrier. So my first exposure to Zen, as I was sitting there, I went on a retreat with my mom. I was about 10 years old, and she being the youngest, and I guess she couldn't find a babysitter or something like that, I don't know, she brought me with her into the retreat. And it wasn't a Zen retreat, it was a one-day sort of retreat every month that the Buddhist temple in Toronto would host. So it's like a one day that people would go to the temple, and for 24 hours they would follow a monastic schedule. So they get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and they sit for an hour, and then after that they would chant some mantras for another hour, and they would have breakfast. And then they would listen to Dharma talks. Listen to Dharma talks and do a little bit of, self-care in the morning. And then come back for lunch. They would have a nap. I love, Vietnamese retreats the siesta is always built in. Because I've gone to many retreats, that's outside of the Vietnamese community. I noticed the nap's not built in. Why are we resisting nature, right? Nature is, after you eat, you got full, your body needs to rest and relax and sleep so all of your blood can go into your stomach to digest, right? So it makes sense to nap. Everybody gets an afternoon nap, and then they get up and they listen to another Dharma talk. I call it a class, because everybody brings a notepad. And then they have a little bit of free time, and then they go chant again. Right? So the day is pretty much, it's very, very filled. It's a typical monastic schedule that you would find in a Vietnamese monastery. And so, that day of retreat to observe a monastic schedule for Vietnamese Buddhist lay people, so you give them an exposure of what it's like to live as a monk or nun. It's sort of like they think of it as planting the seeds. So in the future, for maybe this life or the future lives, you can be, you become a nun or a monk. They think that is a good endeavor to eventually they'll be a monastic, to live a monastic life. So here I am, 10 years old. I got taken with my mom to these 24-hour monastic schedule retreat. You get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sit for an hour. And I was probably the only kid there. So over 100 people. And so everybody gets into the main Buddha hall and sits for an hour. And here I am sitting on a cushion for an hour. And my leg's killing me. I've never meditated before. Okay. It's almost like throwing me in the deep end. I was a pretty good kid, so I basically, you're in the middle of 100 people, you better do what they do, right? So I try to sit there for an hour with everybody else. My foot was killing me. My mind was wandering to no end. It was spinning. Sweat was pouring down my my face. As I endured the whole thing, it was pure torture. And I thought to myself, why are these adults, what the hell are they doing for them to themselves? So the first thing I've learned is aversion, right? And this uncomfortable experience of your leg killing you because you have to sit still for a cross-legged for an hour. And believe me, I'm trying to be like an adult, so I was in full lotus position. Very painful. Even though I was very flexible, but it was super, super painful. And so for the whole hour, I'm basically biting down and enduring it, right? Cannot escape from this painful experience. Sitting in a room more than 100 people with this monk in front that's, kind of like the headmaster. Didn't want to get in trouble if I move. So it's almost like a torture, right? So that was my first experience of meditation. Is recognizing the aversion. And let me tell you, my mind was going, when's this ending? When's this ending? When this ending? It's almost like a mantra for an hour, right? And so when we go into the Dharma talks and the monks talks about how we try to avoid our experiences, I was like, bingo, that's what I experienced this morning. And so what you discover in the Zen practice is that There are some experiences we cannot avoid. Okay? And when we sit down for an hour every day to practice, we realize that we can't even control those experiences. What we can do is dispassionately observe them and understand them and see how they work when our attention flows to them or not. Okay? So this is a little exercise that we did at the beginning of the Bodharma talk. Notice the body, right? Notice the sensations. Those are the first two foundations of the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness or observing of what's going on, reality. Right? So when you observe the body, you're shifting your attention, your awareness away from the thinking mind. Okay. And then it becomes the thought dies down. The thought just goes down. It quiets down. When you start to observing the sort of contact between your senses with whatever is around you, what you've also noticed is when the contact happens between your senses and the corresponding sort of things that react to those senses, your perception jumps in and labels it. Your mind jumps in and labels it, turns it into language. And then something else jumps in. The preference. Grasping it if you like it. Pushing away or resisting it if you don't like it. And neutral. So in the second foundation of the observations that the Buddha taught, you discover that. In the third observations, the observations of the mind, you notice, what is mine? That's the question that few of us ask. We make these assumptions that mine is that thinking mind, is that for that ongoing process of language, or should I say, the voices in your head. Now, if you say that to a psychiatrist, they would think, oh no. But the truth is, we all have voices in our head. And people would ask me, are you thinking in Vietnamese or English? Right? And those voices have a specific language, right? French for you? Who knows? Right? So, and sometimes these voices have particular character, right? Like when I do therapy with my clients, I do part work. And the voices are sometimes very judgmental, you know, very critical, almost like a critical parent. That's saying, you should do this, you should do that. And, you know, usually the voice that has the word should in it, it's your parents. Okay? They left you some really good presents. Right? And then when you hear that critical voice, you should do this, you should do that, the parent voice comes out. And then some of the voices are like, I don't want to do that. I just want to do nothing, or I just want to play video games. So what voice does that sound like? You're, of course, your two-year-old self, right? Right? But I don't want to go to work. You stay up a little bit too late last night and you wake up in the morning and, you know, your alarm clock goes up and the first voice that goes onto your head is, oh my God, I'm so tired. I don't feel like I'm going to work today. Whose voice is that? You see? This is observing mind. Okay? what is mind? Is the mind those different voices that you're hearing? Is it an alto, soprano? Okay, but it gets to that point. It's a little serious. Okay. So, what is mind? Is it those voices? What is mind when you don't have a voice in your head? When it's quiet? Where is mind? We rarely have that question, right? We rarely look at our own mind. Because we make this assumption that those voices are who we are, is our mind. Well, what happens? What is mind when there's no voices? Where is mind? Do we make that false assumption that mind is that voice in our head? What is mind? In close up, and this is the kind of questioning we all should take and make our own observations and investigation. Because nobody's going to answer you that question. It's not going to satisfy you. Why? Because this is your own mind we're talking about. Nobody knows your own mind better than you. Unless you're not observing your mind at all. Which unfortunately is a lot of people, right? But when upon close observations of our own mind, I asked you, where's your mind when you're not thinking? What is mind? Is it the thinking process? When the thinking process is not there and you're just observing your body and your sensations. Is your mind those sensations in your body? Okay. What are the factors of mind? You notice all that labeling that's going on as you identify things? Is your mind that labeling part? Maybe. Maybe that's a part of it. So, what part of your mind is transient and which is permanent? So don't jump to quick conclusion, right? Just pose the question. And then observe. Because no answer will satisfy you because it's somebody else's answer. Only when you do your own investigation and only through a thorough and long process of investigating over time. So we're not talking about collecting data for this moment in time. We're talking about collecting data over a longer period of time. That then you can draw your conclusions better. Right? So for the Buddha, this investigation is done through the four foundations of observations, or we call the four foundations of mindfulness, right? Observing the body, observing the contact between body, sensation, a body senses, all the five senses. Contacts with the corresponding objects to it that it can receive. Observing mind, the factors of the mind. To put aside all of our assumptions, what is mind? And then sit in meditation and observe our own mind and answer that question ourselves. And once we observe mind, we have a close observations of our own mind. Which, by the way, Descartes is wrong. He says, I think, therefore I am. Well, what happens when you stop thinking? Are you gone? Are you gone? You're not gone. You're still here. So he has a wrong conclusion. And the last foundation of observations that the Buddha taught is to observe the dharmas, or he says things. What is things? All objects, whether physical, mental, emotional, sensory, that can be observed through your awareness. All objects, all dharmas. Dharmas has multiple meanings, or the meanings are teachings, or the meanings are objects. All objects in existence. Why are we observing all objects in existence? To discern for ourselves. It's not subject. Objects and subjects are two different things, right? And so, when I was engaged in intense meditation retreats, a senior monk would tell me, don't be locked in subject-object duality. That's a pointer for me. He says, to be liberated is to be free from this subject-object duality that your average person is constantly engaging in. Oh boy. How do we get there? Well, we get there by not identifying with the object that arises. Right? When you sit and you observe your mind, what do you notice? Stream of consciousness, or I should say stream of thinking. It's like a waterfall, one after another that's going, right? Is that you? Never mind whatever it's saying, It's not the content. It's the actual form. The form of all those kind of bombardment of thoughts is not the box and what's in it. It's the structure. So the structure of the thoughts is, where did it arise? How did it arise? Where it came from? And when it arises, what is its manifestation in relation to other objects, which is your body? Why do I call it the body an object? Because you can observe it, right? What do I call thoughts or streams of consciousness that you can observe? An object, because you can observe it. If you see it, it's not you. Does it make sense? Okay. And a lot of people mistaken this, right? So they buy into the story that their mind is weaving, and they're like, I am that story. Right? They buy into the label that the mind creates and says, I am that label. When the label changes, oh my God, I don't know who I am. So it's called the identity, the self. And so this delusion constantly is weaved in our mind over and over again by these objects that rise and fall. Why do I say they rise and fall? Because when you're asleep, what are they? You see them? At some point in your sleep, it's completely cut off, right? Only in REM sleep, or you're dreaming, all these objects arise again. But in deep sleep state, they're completely vacant. So, what happened? When you wake up, when you come into conscious awareness again, the object rises again. So, they fall and they rise. They don't have constant reality. You grab on to these things to be who you are, you're in trouble. Because why? It's got no solid foundation. You want to define who you are, define it on something that doesn't change. You define who you are, you grab on all these different objects that come and go as who you are. When they change, you're almost like this man who's drowning in the river, you know? One log, you know, just breaks out that you can't hold on anymore. You have to find a raft to grab on to stay afloat. That's what we're constantly doing. We're doing that unconsciously and consciously all the time. And we're not even aware of this process. No wonder we call something, we have something called insecurity. You see, I was always interested in this sort of, I wouldn't call it mystical thing, but this self-investigation thing when I was a kid, till much later in my life, and pretty much for most of my life. So I got very attracted to psychology very early, you know, Freud and Jung and all of that stuff, and philosophy and questioning all kinds of different things. And so my first cone was, who am I? And I started questioning myself when I was a teenager. And everybody was like, this girl's weird. She asked questions none of us could answer. or people come up with easy answer. You know, who are you? I'm Vietnamese. Right? Well, what if there's no Vietnam country anymore? There's a period of time when Vietnam in history was taken over by the Chinese for 1,000 years. And, you know, do I call myself Chinese? So it's sort of like all this stuff is shifting, right? So I've noticed all this shifting stuff. And I was like, okay. So as a teenager, most people are trying to define themselves, right? So they're building their self-identity, right? So they're like, I'm a creative person. And then I found out that I wasn't very creative. I wasn't very good at creating. There was a lot of people who are much better at it than me as a creator. And then I would say, I'm a very good person. And then I, on close observations, I saw myself do naughty things. Which every teenager does, by the way. And, you know, and so my mom would scold me and say, you're a bad girl. You shouldn't be doing those things. And I, you know, I grab onto that label and I go, I'm a bad girl. I feel bad, you know. And then on close observations, actually, no, I do some pretty good things in my daily chores. I help my mom around the house and things like that. You know, so it's like, I'm so confused. These labels don't stick, right? And when we find out that none of these labels sticks, and we're so confused as to what to believe, it's called an identity crisis. See, so the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha taught, is to observe these objects and notice the transient nature of these objects. And not to rely on them, to hold on them as a belief, as a basis for your reality, because they're transient. So we go through the process of elimination. I'm that, okay, that moved, so I'm not that. I'm this, okay, this moved too, so I'm not this. So, yeah, I went through a period of elimination and I realized, oh my God, I'm almost able to eliminate almost everything. Who am I then? I don't know who I am. So I walked around with a little bit of that for a while. I call this identity or lack of identity anxiety. And in psychology, if you have some of those, they call it borderline personality disorder. If you have other symptoms, by the way, that's not the only symptom, but you know, but the truth is that is a recognition of what is really going on, that our identity is entirely constructed by all these transient objects. With transient nature. And so the only place left for you to go is find your Buddha nature. The part that doesn't change, doesn't move, isn't transient. The one thing that remains the same throughout your entire experience of childhood till now, because let me tell you, how many things have changed for you since childhood till now? Okay, you got to go through a process of elimination. Take out a long, long paper, write down. What changed? Okay. I know for some of you, it's not a piece of paper, it's a book. Right? And this is the Zen investigation. This is what the four foundations of mindfulness was actually supposed to be doing. This is what the Buddha taught the four foundations of mindfulness for. We're doing that investigation, that inquiry into the nature of our experiences. So, it was heaven sent when I hear people say in Zen, your Buddha nature doesn't change, doesn't move, doesn't go away. Oh, wow, that's nice. That would take away my insecurity. Because why? Because if you built your identity on all the things that are shifting, you'd be very insecure. Because it's going to go away, right? My friend, my mom has a old classmate from Vietnam, and he was very successful. You know, he was a refugee. He in the war, he was in I call it the Green Beret version of the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese army. So he was a lieutenant in the Green Beret, and then when the war ended, he went to Australia, was very, you know, went back to school, became a lawyer again, and thought of himself as being very successful, that he worked for a company, a shipping company, a transnational shipping company, and he rose to the rank of director. And he was very proud of himself, big ego. When I talked to him, he's like, oh my God, I got, you know, chauffeur to this place and that place. And, you know, and then he got sick. And then all of that went away. And he's left on a wheelchair. And every time my mom would talk to him, he would ask about me, and I would take the phone, and he would talk to me about his former life, the glory of it all, right? Because he can't acknowledge that it's gone. Because when it's gone, he's left with a guy on a wheelchair. It's devastating. So his former identity, he cannot let go. But acknowledging that is devastating. You see, this is what happens with identities, is that it eventually shifts. It eventually changes. And then we're left with this emptiness. When that object moved on, whether that object is physical, really outside, you know, like a definite chair that a director sits on, or it's just a mental label or language label that you get on your business card. Or it's just a concept. So the insecurity of all this. We're building our house that the ego resides on shifting sands. What do? Well, the solution for this is to find your Buddha nature. That's permanent. And then reside in that. Instead of identifying with all the things that are shifting and changing. The Buddha says the end of suffering also entails the end of fear. And after many, many, many years of reading, you know, Buddhist texts, I realized that, you know, the end of fear is the end of suffering. Because what is fear? Fear is anxiety. Right? So there's a fun story of, this is a Theravadin story. There's a fun story of this very enlightened master. And he one day he meditated. And he thought he was enlightened. So he went to one of his colleagues and said, I think I became an arahat. And his colleague says, well, you think? And he goes, yeah, I think so. And you know, an arahat is like a fully enlightened being. Right? So his colleagues having superpowers and whatever, and you have to take these stories with a grain of salt, suddenly turn into this huge, big, great elephant with tusk and overtowering, standing over him. And the so-called self-proclaimed arahat recoiled in fear. That's going to be trampled on, right? And then his friend turns back into a monk and goes, you freaked out. I don't think you're free. Why? Because fear is associated with the identification of a transient thing. What's transient? Your body. You see what I mean? It's a good test. So, when you're no longer identified with a transient thing, fear is no longer present. And this is, now, let me reiterate this. Fear and danger is two different things. Dara and I walked the dogs and came face to face with danger, a very, coyote that is not scared of human beings. We try to scare it away. Blow a bear horn and it won't go away. So that's danger. Okay? That's real danger. It is not fear. Okay? We calmly dealt with it. We calmly try to chase it away and it refused to go away. So we calmly says, we'll leave. So we left the park. Right? In a way of saying, you know, there's four of us and there's one of you. So try not to pick a fight with us. We'll leave nicely. Right? But that's danger. Right? Danger and fear are two different things. When you're in the throes of danger, you probably likely find yourself reacting pretty quickly and calmly to whatever danger that's happening. It's when you have a moment to actually frame that danger in your head, that fear happens. Oh my God, did you just notice what happened? Right? And that's what I found with a lot of things related to what is fear and what is danger. Right? Real danger. It's very different than fear. Okay? And the problem is we walk around with a lot of fear. It stops us from being alive. It stops us from truly being free. And so the four foundations of mindfulness, or I call it the four foundations of investigation that the Buddha taught, applied this way, has the capacity to liberate the person who is applying this practice. Liberate them from this experience of, I call, existential anxiety. Why? Because your existence is relying on transient things. Of course you'd be fearing death. Because when this transient thing goes away, you think you go away. And that's the problem. So, I think it is imperative that all of us take in this practice, this close observations, this inquiry of who we really are. Why? Because you're all going to be dead. The statistic is 100%. Right? So if you're identifying with anything that's transient, right? Of course, we all in some sense identify with our body, you know? When it's a little bit ugly, we're like, oh, I'm so ugly. So embarrassing. You know? You see? So we're identifying with the body. So if the body starts to degrade, you know, we're going to have existential problem. So it's imperative that we make this practice. I call it, you know, put the fire under your butt. Make this practice a priority. Why? Because you can skip paying the bills when you're dead. But you can't avoid death. Pretty much a reality. But if we don't make this investigation, we're going to face that with fear, trepidation. And we're going to face it. Well, Shakespeare's call it a place where no travelers return. Don't know about the people who come back and tell you, you know, near-death experience. I don't know about that. I really want to know about the people who actually died and come back. But of course, nobody's coming back after 3 days of death, right? So no travelers return to tell you what's going on the other side. So it's your priority to investigate. What endures? And don't give me that you know, answer of the soul, my spirit. Where is that? Nobody, you don't know where it is? What is that? What does it look like? So again, that flimsy assumption answer cannot be tested. Go test it. Why? Because I'm not going to die for you. You're gonna die for you. Okay, I can't do that for you. It's your life. It's your experience. Go investigate. Liberate yourself. The Buddha says, once you liberate yourself, you realize the deathless and the birthless. And that's when samsara ends. When the cycle of existence ends. When freedom happens.
This podcast is created by members of the Clear Way Zen Sangha. If you enjoyed the talk and wish to show support, donation information can be found on our website, www.clearwayzen.ca. Thank you for listening.